ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. My guest today is Lexi Mills, Managing Director at Marquee Communications. Lexi is a multi-award-winning digital marketing expert, specializing in integrating PR and SEO at both a strategic and tactical level. Her research work focuses on the opportunities, ethics, and risks of machine learning and AI within the sector of internet search. Lexi, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be speaking with you too.
I saw a TED talk you gave and it really stayed with me. And you said how when we meet and interact with people, we know that we're interacting and telling that person all sorts of things about ourselves, both through our words and our body language and our behaviors, but that we all forget that with the internet, it too is looking back at us. And I was wondering if you could describe what this means a little bit more.
Sure. So, you know how when you look in a mirror, you get a reflection of who you are, and it's actually inverted. And I think something similar happens with the internet. It inverts certain aspects of our characteristics, and sometimes this can be good and sometimes it can be bad. For example, we're more likely to be mean on things like Twitter than we would be in real life. The saying I always quite like is Oscar Wilde's, give a man a mask and he'll tell you the truth. And, you know, or man is least himself in his own suit, give him a mask and he'll tell you the truth. And the internet in many ways gives us a mask. It gives us a sense of anonymity. And that allows us to explore things we wouldn't naturally explore in real life. So your Google search history might show that you have some very interesting interests or hobbies. They're still part of who you are, right? But you might not walk around advertising those. And if they're just bizarre, unusual things, I quite like making things. So I'm always researching weird bits of metal and unusual pliers for making fixings. And that's not a bad thing. And it might be if I wore that more on my sleeve, I'd meet more people like me. But in the same vein, if you're into child pornography, that can remain a secret. And therefore, that part of you is hidden and puts other people in danger. Equally, if you take it a step further, you're more likely to complain online than you are in real life. I'm actually in the UK at the moment. I live in New York. But we were having a conversation about how important the internet is to feedback and hospitality in the United Kingdom versus the US, because we don't like to complain. We don't like confrontation. Whereas, as a sweeping generalization, Americans are better at giving feedback.
It's a nice way to put it.
But it's from a hospitality management perspective, it's actually really important to know where things are going wrong or where they're going right. But you don't always want a footprint for it. I left some rather mean reviews about dry cleaner a couple of weeks ago. Feel a bit bad about it. It was one incident that's going to stay with him forever. And it's actually tracked to me because it's on my Google account. So it's a reflection of who I am. But it's also a reflection of that business, which is inaccurate, and it could impact his ability to make revenue. So I think we have to be aware that the data sets that we put out show us things. And I find it kind of interesting. So I have a friend who's manic depressive, and I track the internet search behavior. And if I see too much time on Facebook without them actually clicking on it or taking any actions, I'm pretty certain they're heading for a crash. And that's super insightful. It means I can go visit and hopefully pull them out of it before they have the crash. And when people are manic, it's not just the experience of the manic episode, but it's also the memory of the manic episode that's traumatic. So in that sense, having the internet looking back at us, giving us a greater sense of who we are, who somebody else is, and where they are, can actually help us prevent trauma. And there are some really interesting studies that show that we can actually predict health conditions before we even have any physical symptoms. Cancer, some forms of cancer have been very successful in terms of looking at someone's internet data and being able to say, you're going to get this type of cancer. Now, those studies are in elementary forms, but they're pretty conclusive at this point. And if you consider taking, let's just say hypothetically, taking your medical records and handing over your IP address and saying, here's my DNA, and you give all of that to the DNA sequencing program, think how fast we had advanced that. Because we'd be able to correlate medical conditions with search behavior and with DNA, and they could all feel each other. So they could tell us a lot more about ourselves than we would know for many years. And if we can learn to understand our DNA better, we can prevent future illness even better. So it's kind of a rabbit hole that's really good fun to go play in, but it's interesting to learn more about yourself. I don't know if you've ever had adverts show and you've been like, oh, why is that showing?
It's sometimes I think, oh, my phone has been listening to me because it's serving up what I was just talking about, and it's served up. And I actually find that a little unsettling. Or the other thing is sometimes if I've just purchased something, you know, like a vacuum cleaner, all of a sudden all these ads for vacuum cleaners, as if I'm this strange vacuum cleaner collector, is, you know, they're being served up as well. So I guess that's a kind of flaws in the system a bit.
There are definitely flaws in this system, especially when it comes to the ad tech. You know, a classic example is when Target got told off for showing a teenage girl pregnancy products, and she didn't know she was pregnant yet, and nor did her father, who went into Target and had quite a large tantrum and then had to backtrack and apologize. But yes, being shown products that you've already purchased, not massively helpful or insightful. But for example, when I first moved from the United Kingdom to the US, I got a list of all the people that I thought were most interesting. And then I went through all their social profiles and I found all the places they had checked in, from restaurants through to nightclubs through to shops, and I correlated them. And I found the most consistent places that all the most interesting people I knew used to go to. And so I followed all those pages and I went to all those places, and then I got served adverts for events, parties, venues, restaurants that were in line with that sort of constructed filter bubble I'd created, which meant I felt super at home in New York within like 2 months. Whereas when I first moved to Britain, that technology didn't really exist. Certainly social media was infancy. And so settling into Britain and finding places where I wanted to be, where there were other humans that I identified with, was a lot harder.
Oh, that's really interesting. I mean, but that's so clever to do that. I think that that's sort of, you're engineering it in a way that a lot of people don't take advantage of it. One of the things that I think people don't necessarily really wrap their heads around is the sheer volume of searching. Can you give us a sense of the order of magnitude that we're dealing with on a daily basis?
Oh, I'll have to pull up that stat. It is wild, because it's not just the searches themselves. So whilst I'm pulling up the volume of searches, which I'll do whilst we're chatting, you've got to bear in mind that it's time on page. How many pages did you click? How many pages did you scroll through? So at the moment, I'm running a study to work out how people search relating to cancer-based search queries. So I want to know if they search, for example, lung cancer survival rates, do they click on the first result and read all the paraphernalia that tells them how to interpret a result? Or do they just go straight to the bottom of the page and look for the table, the thing that says stage one, X amount of years, stage two, X amount of months? And the preliminary tests I've done show that essentially what we do is we just look for the stat straight away. Now, actually, that's really unhealthy, because when you go straight to the stat, you don't realize that actually, if you don't know the type of cancer and you don't know if it will where it is, you know, for example, you can't operate on cancer that's right behind the heart very easily, then those stats aren't relevant. But when you're in a state of trauma, you're looking for security, you're looking for something to hold on to. So we'll search something, click on a result, and scan down the page. Now, if we had really intelligent search as opposed to efficient search, what it would do is remove that table and you would have to read certain information and click to bring up that table, so that by the time you look at that data, you can put it in an accurate context. Otherwise, you're actually just serving someone's nervousness. And we can probably work all of that out with the existing technology we have. We just have to combine it with Google search technology. And then we move from efficient search into highly intelligent search. And you know, those are all very minute data points that we're tracking. But there would be a lot of other searches that happened before that. For example, you maybe you're researching a cough, maybe you've got a cold that won't go, then a sore throat, then shortness of breath. Well, really, all of those data points and how long you're searching them and how frequently you're searching them could be a very good indicator that something's quite seriously wrong. Because we all live in a very busy world. We're being hit with data 24/7, filtering it out. You know, survival is hard. Just, you know, life management is consuming. And sometimes we don't realize how long we've been unwell for or how long something's been a concern. But if Google turned around and gave you the About You page and said, did you realize you've Googled headaches 4 times a month, every month for 3 years? Maybe you should go investigate this.
Right. Well, that's interesting. One of the things, I mean, is Google moving toward intelligent search versus efficient search? Because it seems like the algorithms serve up information based on efficiency, really. And that's part of one of the problems of creating these sort of bubbles, because it's popularity maybe more than accuracy.
Yeah. I think Google's done a great job with the algorithm. I can't critique it. I just think maybe we need to lift our eyes a little bit higher. It's funny, when you walk around a city, you end up looking at all the shop windows, all the signs, all the graffiti, all the interesting characters, and you so often forget just to tilt your head up and see the sky and the skylines. And I think maybe we need to do the same with search. We've been so focused on making it really efficient and answering our questions. But we now at a point where I think we need to be stepping back and saying, when someone asks a question, do they actually need, want that answer? Is that, in fact, the right question to ask?
Well, do we want a service to tell us or assume that it knows what we want or need, though? I mean, I guess that's the other piece, right? Because you're going to have biases in terms of who's designing the intelligence, quote unquote, aspect of the algorithm. I mean, how do you combat the bias that's even in terms of all the data points that are being collected, because a human hand is in the creation of those data points?
It's definitely an issue, but arguing that we shouldn't be doing things differently doesn't change the fact that it's actually already happening. You know, where it's somebody or a machine is already deciding these things. My view is that everything we do online is feeding into an ecosystem of data that we have a right to. It's our data that's feeding the algorithm, and at a significantly advanced rate now that machine learning and AI has been introduced to the algorithm, because before Google was saying they weren't going to use it. But now Google's using it. That the algorithm in some ways, I think we could argue, it is all ours. Although Google manages and builds it, we are part of it. Everyone who feeds into it. You know, our data is being tracked even when we're in airplane mode.
Right.
So we should be making the very best use of this data set. And if it can give us further insights about ourselves, that's super helpful. You know, in the days where we spent, our main concern was feeding ourselves and shelter, we had more time to ponder certain things and be more connected with our sense of self, our body. We'd be aware that we'd had a headache a lot. But life is really busy, and when you've got all this data coming at you, I mean, I am old enough to remember not having email on my phone.
Oh, yeah.
It changes things. You lose, for everything you gain, you lose something. I'm a massive believer that you don't make choices. You pick sets of consequences. And the sets of consequences we have by having amazing technology is that we lose a little bit of time and self-awareness. And if the technology can give that back to us, that's brilliant. And if it can give it back to us and actually enhance our lives, even better.
Right. What about sort of bad actors, if you will? I mean, I saw a talk, and Garry Kasparov was very fixed on the idea that it's fine in a free society that we're going to have all this data, and brute force machine learning is going to, you know, these huge amounts of samples, and they can recognize and learn. But what do you do when all of that is being captured and organized in maybe not a free society? Or, you know, so as an individual, how concerned should you be, and how much choice do you have anyway? I mean, do you have any thoughts on that?
So I believe in fighting battles you can win. But it's true. You've got to put your energy where it's worth being spent. I saw a talk by a DNA specialist, And even if you anonymize DNA, he can pretty much find your house. So his argument is that everyone is scared to give their DNA because of confidentiality and data and things like that. But in reality, all our data and all our confidentiality is somewhat gone. And what we really need is trust. I was like, oh, that's frick. We've got a systemic problem and now we have to solve it with a fluffy skill. This isn't going to work, right?
That's so true though. And it's especially right now, what an interesting, that's true. Interesting challenge, I would say for sure, because trust is the challenge, isn't it?
Well, I think we also need to look at how the internet is structured. So my argument is that the internet is the biggest growing land mass in the world. If we consider it more as a place, a territory, all countries are represented at the United Nations by a board. They get a voice. They get a say. Key issues have a place to go. But the internet is kind of like the Wild West, right? So police manage, internet crime. But at the rate that technology is developing, an issue comes about and we fix it, right? And then another one comes up and then we fix it, instead of preempting the problems and building in solutions. And being reactive in street crime or other areas of issues and concern is productive. But when you look at the exponential rate that technology is developing, by being reactive, what we're essentially doing is, bear with me here, imagine a field, and this field is filled with bunnies. Each bunny is a problem. You shoot one bunny, okay. Well, bunnies like to breed, and they breed really fast, and that's what's happening with technology. It's breeding problems at an exponential rate, and shooting one bunny at a time is not going to solve the problem. We need to stand back and say, how do we regulate for this? How do we protect something that really should be one of the greatest assets humanity has ever created? And do we really protect it by it largely being owned by one corporate entity? Probably not. There's, we don't let corporates own whole countries. And in that sense, I think we need to start rethinking about who's looking after our internet. Who's the caretaker? Who's going to protect it on our behalf? Is it really something that the government should be doing? Or should we have our own internet government, perhaps?
What do you think about the argument that blockchain technology, where everybody actually would control their piece and it's, distributed databases of information, but you, rather than having, let's say, all your social information be resident in Facebook, you control your social information, you control your medical information, you control it, and then it's divvied out as necessary, but it resides with you, sort of as internet 2.0. Do you see that as anything, or is that not really how it would pan out?
It's a great question. And I feel like these are the sort of questions we should all be having on a daily basis. I can tell you what my thoughts are now. My thoughts on these subjects change every single day, which is what makes it hard to advocate for them because everything's changing constantly. But my argument would be that, okay, yeah, that might help. It might solve some issues. But what it doesn't do is allow us to access the full potential of the integration of this data.
True.
So, and that's what I want. Mm-hmm. I want, and right now, actually, in Britain, the NHS handed over all the health records of UK citizens to Google DeepMind in that part of a big deal that they did. So we'd have to get data back. Uh-huh. It's not even a matter of not giving it out. We'd have to get stuff back. Uh-huh. We do have control of what we put on Facebook. We don't have control of the tracking. And I think, you look at small children now do internet safety classes, but not many people talk about adult internet safety classes. And most people aren't aware that they're seeing localized results. They aren't aware that the results they're seeing are tailored specifically to them. So they don't even realize that they're missing a bit. Mm. It's a bit like, I always think of the Matrix, is it the blue or the red pill? Okay, so Neo gets offered two pills and he can pick one or the other. The difference is, with the way customized and localized search algorithms work, a lot of people don't even realize the other pill exists.
Right.
So maybe what we need is greater awareness of how the search technology works, because it does work and it is awesome. And when I need to boil an egg, it's rocking. I never remember how to boil an egg. I always have to double check and I find out instantly. So Google performs really highly there. And if it could also tell me when I'm getting sick, well before I get sick, that's brilliant too. And if it could get a little bit better about answering what is the meaning of life, that would be great. If you've ever put that search query in, the response is dismal. You know, Google's aspiration is to provide the best result for a searcher's query. And you type in, what is the meaning of life? And it is just the most horrendous result. It makes me weep. If I was Google, I would be putting a whole project behind just adapting that query. And also, what is love? If you search what is love and click images, and I've done this all over the world, it doesn't actually show you really the grand capacity that love could be. And you know, one of the examples I like to share is when you search for pilots, you don't get that many females. And so this starts to shape our sense of what is normal. It's a calibration point. Whereas if I search pilots and it was filled with women, I'd be like, yeah, I'm going to be a pilot.
Right.
But, you know, we don't self-identify if it's a page full of men, or I wouldn't.
Right. Right.
So just being aware of where it shaped what is normal and what is possible, I think would be really productive.
Well, that's sort of what I was getting at in terms of the machine learning and the data points and what the current data points are influencing what future perspective is. You see what I'm saying? So if the current data points are most of the pilots happen to be men because we have a structural society in which men happen to become pilots, and so when the machine learning is happening, this is what it recognizes and serves up as pilot. But then are you going to ossify, not because the machine has any, it's a machine, it doesn't care one way or the other, but because that was our society, it then continues that trend, you know, and what does that mean? I also think it's curious. As you were talking, I decided to Google, what is the meaning of life? And what's interesting is sort of the second search for me was, what is the meaning of 42? Because I thought that's fantastic. And would somebody else get that? I really made me laugh. Hitchhiker's Guide. There you go. Meaning of life and everything.
The best result Google has for what is the meaning of life? Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Right. Oh, funny.
I have a couple of ideas. And I actually think the ideas themselves are probably worth executing as to raise awareness for issues. So, you know how you can have children search on, which stops kids finding dodgy stuff?
Mm.
What if you had a feminine search, but I'd like to call it wild succulent woman search, right? And you click that and all your search results are adapted to just show you inspiring, powerful women doing loads of cool stuff. So it widens your perspective on what women can do and have done. But you could turn it on and off. Right? Because you don't want to completely warp what is reality. I mean, the internet isn't a complete accurate reflection of reality, but it is to a certain degree. So when I'm speaking to clients who are hiring fast, for example, and we're looking at their website, we're looking at their job specs, and I say to them, right, you need to hire more women, but you don't have many women on your team. So why don't we do women who want to get into search event, promote that, take photos of it, get those photos indexed, instead of trying to get every woman in the office to stand in every single photo of the company so it looks like you have a balanced male-female ratio, and then a woman rocks up there and it's all men. You know, so there is a certain level of integrity that has to come with adjusting search results. But I would really like to know what wild succulent women search looks like. You know, what things do I not even realize are bias? So, for example, there's a little tool you can use that will go over your job specs, and it's automated, but it will highlight areas that are actually non-female friendly. And I actually know some of the big publishers use this when advertising for roles, which is how I first discovered it. And I thought, oh, that's really cool. Like, maybe just being aware of when somebody's being biased is helpful. And I think also, let's be fair here, I think sometimes bias gets taken to an extreme. And so maybe it could also tell us when we're being raging, offensive feminists as opposed to wild, succulent feminists.
Right, right. Well, that's fascinating. The job specs tool, what would be interesting there is it ageist? Is it, you know, there are all sorts of interesting tweaks in that. I want to sort of bring the conversation a little bit. Most of my audience is involved in entertainment, and SEO functions in terms of sort of the screen touch point that helps people discover new content, often pirate new content. And I'm curious about, you know, when you've got something that hasn't previously existed, you know, like a program, like Stranger Things before Stranger Things was Stranger Things, if you will, how do people effectively think about how they should use SEO? If we think about these biases and bubbles and that people tend to be drawn to, I don't know, what's popular gets picked up, you know, trivial ideas and salacious ideas, you know, you get a lot of hits. So when you're thinking about entertainment, where a lot of times it's brand new, it hasn't existed before, and it's complex because you've got to decide, you know, what is this thing that you're talking about? How should people in marketing and promotion of entertainment think about the ways in which these algorithms work?
So the easiest thing to do, and I do this across all my campaigns, is just find four people that actually like the product and four people that don't. Then I will ask them, can I see your Netflix? And I'll see what they've watched recently. And I'm like, ah, okay, is there a correlation between these four people? Because, you know, you can walk around a coffee shop and ask strangers these kind of questions, right? Not all of them will show you their Netflix, but you can ask them what they watch, things like that. And, you know, if you're doing it with friends, you can have a look on their Facebook. What are the correlating factors? And you're like, ah, people into Stranger Things are also into Black Mirror, and they're potentially into Travelers, which is the show I just started watching. And you're like, okay, so let me look at the tags associated with these programs. So you can look at the news coverage. Like if you put into Google, I was doing this the other week, I did a finance launch, and I put the client's name into Google, clicked news, and I noticed that it said the client's name, it said startups, it said technology. And I was like, oh, that's kind of cool, because I can go put all those three tags into my media database and pull up a list of journalists that cover those sectors. Mm-hmm. So if you can do back analysis on something that's similar and then find the correlating factors, that's a great starting point. And then you start to think, okay, what is it about this that is important and current? Now, there's a difference between making news and faking news. And I think it's really important that any good piece of marketing is underpinned by integrity. So find an actual truth. What is it that's really good about this? Is it that there's great graphics? Is it that there's really hot people in there that you're going to like watching? You know, is there a good soundtrack? And that becomes the core of your marketing. Because if you try and sell something for what it isn't, you will fall flat. But if you sell it for what it is, you're going to be a lot more successful. And that will help you find the next market that you go into. You're like, okay, so I need to find people that watch Black Mirror and Travelers and are into the Rolling Stones.
When you're working with your clients, you're not purely talking to them about SEO. You're using that to inform your larger approach about how they work across all different aspects of marketing and launching things, correct?
Yes. I mean, clients aren't massively different to normal internet searches in that often I find they're not asking me what I think are the most important questions. They'll say, how do we get links? And I'll look at them and say, how do you make money? And then we'll go back to that. And so I had one client last year who wanted to get lots of links for within certain subject areas. And I looked at them and I was like, you have one article on the Washington Post that pretty much drives your entire business. We're talking about $13 million a month because the deals they do are so big. So they only need to close one a month. And they tend to be around $10 to $13 million. And I was like, I can go out and get you a bunch of coverage and links, but how about I go and get you another article just like that one on a similar publication to the Washington Post, and we see how that performs. And then if you still want me to go off and build loads of links to random pages, we'll do that.
And I'm sure they didn't. I'm sure they saw the error of their ways, having been schooled appropriately and what they should really focus on. So I, you know, it's amazing. We've actually burned through so much time and there's so much more to talk about. I do have one last question to wrap it up. What's the most important question that people don't ask?
That's a tough one. I think people don't ask someone who really knows. The amount of times I see content fail for, let's say someone's working on a travel site and they decide to make a piece of content about wine and, you know, places to visit where you can go to great wineries. The person making the content, more often than not, doesn't know anything about wine or doesn't care about or has never been to a winery. I think the most important thing you can do is go speak to somebody who is a subject matter expert. And it's pretty easy to find that. Human beings like contact, and we inherently like to share knowledge. And these are very sweeping statements, but you know, I must answer 20, 30 emails a week just because if someone's got a question and I can answer it, I will answer it. And I have a lot of friends. I have a friend who's a wine journalist, and I actually took this one specific piece of content to him. And I was like, what do you think? And he's like, well, what they're really missing is that there's this great flower that goes there. And, you know, that flower can actually go in the wine. It enhances it. And he went off on this whole thing. And I was like, oh, we've missed the whole point of this. He offered something that internet searchers couldn't have found on their own. And being able to offer people something that they couldn't do on their own is probably the key point for any successful content or marketing campaign.
That is amazing. Perfect. I love it. So what a wonderful note to end on. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun. And I almost want to schedule like conversation number two to cover the rest of my 50 questions, which I didn't get to yet. But thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I'm always happy to chat. You ask great questions. I'm still trying to even work out what the right questions are when it comes to the health and well-being of what I believe is the greatest asset that humanity's ever created. So if you've got any thoughts, I'm always open.
We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who've helped bring the program to life. First, my friend, Rob Naughton, the amazing voice artist who recorded our open. And of course, thanks to my production team over at Microfame Media. And a big thank you to our guest, Lexi Mills. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience. Thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week, right here on Up Next.